It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a political scientist about a challenge to contraceptive coverage under the Affordable Care Act with a case before the U.S. Supreme Court.
First, issues like the long-running war in Syria and the developing crisis in Ukraine keep raising the question, what role should the United States play in international politics?
With the rise of regional powers around the world, places like China, Brazil, India, and Russia, there's been talk that American power and influence are on the decline, but our next guest doesn't buy that line of thinking. Bruce Jones is with us. He's senior fellow and director of the International Order and Strategy Project at Brookings. His new book is Still Ours to Lead, America, Rising Powers, and the Tension Between Rivalry and Resentment. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Bruce, to paraphrase Mark Twain, you say that reports of American decline have been greatly exaggerated. Why?
That's right. For two reasons. First, when you look at the fundamentals of American power, I think it becomes clear that we are not a power in decline. We're an enduring power on the international stage. And second, when you look at the rising actors, there's been a lot of discussion about the rise of the rest, China, India, Brazil, Russia, etc. What you see is that storyline has been somewhat exaggerated, and that these are powers very deeply divided amongst themselves. The United States does not confront a block of rising powers. It confronts lots of complicated issues, but the United States is an enduring power and still, and for some time to come, by far and away the most influential actor on the world stage.
In your book, you're worried about two foreign policy extremes, a step back from involvement in the world, almost an isolationist approach on the one hand, or take an aggressive, dominant stance with a lot of military intervention. What are you looking for?
I think the United States has to have the confidence of its own position. We have an extraordinary number of assets at our disposal and an astonishing number of allies. And what you see in an acute crisis like the Ukraine, all eyes are on Washington to see how we can lead. There's a risk of overextending ourselves. There's a risk when we resort too quickly to the military tool. We have a whole host of other tools that we can use to galvanize collective action, to isolate countries, to put pressure on countries. The military option has to be there. The military power that we have is an essential component of our leadership. But we have this much broader range of tools, and when we can build strong coalitions with our allies and with some of these new actors with whom we have overlapping interests, we're in a much stronger position.
Well, I mentioned some of the rising regional powers. You did too. There are the BRIC nations. That stands for Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Rising powers that could eclipse American influence, at least in their regions. But you say Russia maybe shouldn't be on that list. Why not?
Well, one of the points I make in the book is that there's no mortar in the bricks. These are very divided powers. But I do think that Russia is a different phenomenon. Russia has recovered since the total collapse of its economy at the end of the Soviet period. So it, from that incredible nadir, it has been rising. But Russia is a deeply dysfunctional country. Its economy is in a shambles. It's in a very weak geopolitical position, and I think we shouldn't overestimate it. The others are actually rising. They are rising economically, and they are rising in their influence. There's a second point. With China, with India, and Brazil, they've buttered their bread on the side of globalization and a stable global system. So although we have tensions with them in their region, security tensions, there's a lot where we have shared interests or overlapping interests. I think it looks very different with Russia.
With Brazil, India, and China in particular, to what extent are they rivals economically, geostrategically, and to what extent are they potential partners?
Yeah, they're both, and I think that's the most important dynamic in the international system right now. All of these are actors who have been in a subsidiary position in the international system. They're frustrated by that. They've grown economically, and they want to exert their influence on the world stage. At the same time, at core, they recognize that they do rely on a stable international system for energy flows, for financial flows, for trade flows, and they can't produce that stability by themselves. They have no real choice but to cooperate with the United States in some places. So in their own regions, they may try to rival us. Globally, they have to cooperate with us, and we have to find a way to live with that duality.
Does the rest of the world want the United States to play a leadership role, or will resentment against us increase when we try to step into that role?
There's nothing worse than American leadership other than all the other options. Every time that it looks like we may step away from a leadership role, people confront the reality that there are no other options, and that the consequence of America stepping away from a leadership function is a void, and more conflict. So people are often frustrated or resentful of American leadership, but when they're actually confronted by the alternatives, they recognize that American leadership is better than those alternatives.
And domestically, do Americans want the country to play a leadership role? There are concerns about costs, getting entangled in foreign conflicts, economic costs, and if the military option is there, cost in human life.
Yes, that's right. And I think what we see, is a sort of divide in the polls where Americans recognize, probably as much as at any point in history, that the United States has no choice but to be engaged in the world. Our economy depends on it. 30% of our economy now depends on foreign trade. There's just no choice but to be engaged in the world. People are gun-shy, though. They don't want us to get ourselves involved in complicated, long, drawn-out wars and repeats of Iraq. And I think the administration and the foreign policy community is going to have to do a better job of explaining why it is that American power helps reduce conflict in a number of ways and prevent aggression in a number of places in a way that's very different than the kind of long entanglements we got ourselves into in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Looking at the last couple of administrations, the second Bush administration, the Obama administration, do you get the sense that there have been guiding doctrines in how we deal with this leadership role, or are we just making it up as we go?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think the Bush administration, for a brief period of time, was a little bit seduced by the scale of American power. They had power at a moment where really the potential rivals out there were extremely weak. There was nothing to constrain American power, and there were some excesses in that mode. I think the Obama administration, by contrast, has been a little too leery, has overlearned some of the lessons of Afghanistan, too much of a sense of any time you step into a conflict, you're going to be sucked into a long quagmire, and that's not always true. Although, to give them credit, I think they played a very different kind of role, for example, in Libya. So every administration struggles with this, and the world has been changing rapidly, and we're beginning to see the administration come to terms with the fact that there is no real alternative still but to American leadership.
But speaking in the abstract so far, let's look at some concrete real-world examples. Ukraine, Russia, Crimea, all over the news lately. What do you think of what you've been seeing in the United States' response to that?
It was interesting watching this. I mean, in the first couple of days, people were awfully critical of the president in terms of the scale and the tenor of the response. But I think even within within a few more days, we've seen that the announcement of the second wave of sanctions, the reinforcing of NATO assets in Eastern Europe, and very importantly, kind of getting on the same page with Europe and working really hard to kind of push the Europeans to be in a more assertive position. There was a lot of wooliness to the early European response. So I think we've seen a pretty clear response from the administration so far. It's not going to reverse Russia's actions in the Crimea, but I think the real test is, does it stop Putin from taking the next step in terms of military intervention deeper into the Ukraine? And we'll have to see in the coming days.
Was there a void in American leadership, though, leading up to this situation, not recognizing what we had to deal with in Putin, maybe being too aggressive to expand NATO eastward, making trade ties with Ukraine that might have ticked Russia off? What did you think of the leadership in the years leading up to this current crisis?
You know, I think one of the challenges that American foreign policy confronts is that we're going to have to come to grips with the reality that there is no alternative to American leadership in Europe, in the Middle East, and in Asia, all at the same time, as well as on major global issues. And we've been in a mode where we can kind of pivot to Asia, we get sucked back into the Middle East, we neglect Europe, and that's just not going to work. And I do think it's the case that as events in Ukraine were unfolding, a lot of our attention was in the Middle East, some of our attention was Asia, and not a lot of our attention was in Europe. And this has reminded us that the European allies are still core to our place in the world. And the United States is going to have to come to terms with that need to be engaged simultaneously in multiple theaters.
Looking at a situation like Syria or Libya that you mentioned earlier, there's a choice sometimes between trying to build a grand coalition, maybe via the UN, but if we're blocked there, maybe with NATO, we're blocked there, we go it alone. How do we navigate that? How do we juggle that?
Yeah, I think the principle is the widest coalition that's possible, right? And so if you can get an extraordinarily broad coalition like we had in support of action in Libya, that's worth getting. And when you have core interests and the coalition isn't there, you're going to have to act. But the real challenge is to recognize that the wider the coalition, the better. and that that doesn't come about just in the moment of the crisis. You have to do a lot of work in advance of a crisis to build the kinds of relationships that matter when you need them in a crisis. And I don't think yet that we're seeing that with respect to countries like India and Brazil and South Africa and Indonesia, all these sort of second-tier emerging powers who are actually very important to the response. We see, for example, in Ukraine, how much Russia has tried to look to India and to China to bolster his argument. They haven't really bolstered it, but I don't think that we've done enough to build our relationship with those countries to broaden the scope of friends that we have in the system.
We're talking about the role of the United States in international affairs, international events, with Bruce Jones. His new book is Still Ours to Lead.
We continue our conversation now with Bruce Jones. He's the author of Still Ours to Lead, and he makes the case that the United States is not in decline on the world stage and that the U.S. should still take an active leadership role.
You can join in the conversation. What role would you like to see the United States play in world politics in general? Should it take a leadership role, or in places like Ukraine and Syria in particular? When should the United States stay out of things? When should we get involved diplomatically, economically, militarily? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. Bruce, it seems like you're calling us to juggle a lot of things, and sometimes it seems like at least we in the media, and I think our government too, kind of focus on the crisis of the moment, the headline of the moment. How can we keep our attention on all those, keep all those balls in the air at the same time?
It's going to be a real challenge. I don't spend a lot of time on this in the book, but I've made the case in other places that the United States is going to have to recognize that it needs high-level diplomatic engagement in all of these regions simultaneously. I'm not convinced that we have the right structure for that. Having a Secretary of State who has to fly back and forth across the Atlantic to the Middle East, flit out to Asia, I'm not sure that that's going to be enough. I think we may need to get innovative about how we structure our diplomatic presence around the world to sustain that high-level political engagement.
Interesting. How do we do that?
We'll have to get creative. I'd be interested in exploring ideas like creating a new position for a deputy secretary of state in Asia based in the region, things like that. I think we have to recognize that these are all regions that are going to want to see high-level political engagement, and it's not enough to have an ambassador or an undersecretary of state following up on these issues sometimes.
Are we a domestically focused nation? Do we not take the rest of the world seriously enough until there's a crisis on our doorstep?
It's very interesting if you look at the polling. I think that's changing a lot. The younger you get in the polling, the more you find people are engaged in the world and interested in the world. I think that's just part of the changing demographics of the country. It's also true when you look at different cities that a lot of the fastest growing cities in the United States now are plugged into global trade. So I think it's changing. I think that people are well aware of what's going on in the world and plugged into the world. There's still this deep debate, of course, about how much of our blood and treasure we should expend and try to lead.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jeff on the line in Green Bay. Jeff, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. No matter what you want, right now the United States does not have a leader that is equipped to handle or lead on the international stage. If you look at the latest gesture with the Soviet Republic and Crimea, the sanctions that he threw out were so utterly pointless. Putin just blew him off and said, I don't care. So right now, no matter what we want, we just don't have a leader that is equipped to lead.
Jeff, thanks for the call. So President Obama doesn't have the stature, the skill to lead in the ways you're looking for, Bruce.
Yeah, I don't agree. Certainly not on the sanctions. The first round of sanctions that he announced were pretty feckless, but within about 3 days, it announced the second round of sanctions, which are much tougher than anything we've seen out of any U.S. administration for 20 years in terms of the dealing with Russia. And he's authorized, he's given himself the authority for a much deeper round of sectoral sanctions, which, if enacted, would really bring the Russian economy to its knees. And there are some risks in that. So I think he's wise to take this in a graduated way. You don't want to rush to a huge trade war with Russia. There are real stakes here. People forget that as we speak, Russia is allowing NATO to overfly its territory and helping us refuel our bases in Afghanistan to deal with the war on terrorism in Afghanistan. So there's a lot at stake here just beyond Crimea. So a kind of graduated response actually makes sense to me. And I think the second round of sanctions have been pretty tough.
You know, that's a theme I see again and again, issues with countries like Iran over their nuclear program, but occasionally cooperation of them on issues related to terrorism. How tough is that to balance? On one hand, we're rivals. We have this core conflict. On the other hand, we have this room for cooperation.
Right, and it's a key theme in my book, hence the subtitle of the tension between rivalry and restraint, because there are places where we have overlapping and shared interests. Defeating Al-Qaeda is one, combating terrorism is one, the Chinese, the Russians, the Indians, the Brazilians, they all share a sense of the threat that terrorism poses, and they're willing to cooperate with us in pretty extensive ways on trade protection, on counter-piracy, on economic issues. There are a whole host of places where we want to cooperate with these states. And at the same time, they're going to challenge us and be rivals to us in a certain set of security issues. Now, I think with Russia, Russia's own actions will have tipped the balance here such that, you know, the rivalry is now going to outpace the cooperation. Still, there are things that they do that are very useful to us.
Go back to our callers now with Bernie in Elkhorn. Bernie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to say that if you look objectively at U.S. history from at least World War II into the present, there are many historians and reporters, Noam Chomsky, et cetera, who could tell you that the United States has been and is an empire. We've got the military in over 130 countries. We have overthrown democratically elected governments in places like Iran, Chile, et cetera. We have illegally invaded and occupied numerous countries. We have drones killing thousands of people illegally in many countries. To say that we have a moral high ground is completely ridiculous. And the only leadership we have is a mafia-type leadership where our military is going to get what it wants in the interest of our corporate interests. And the only other thing that we do is try to do whatever Israel wants. We support hideous regimes like Egypt, Bahrain, Israel, Saudi Arabia. And in the Ukraine, there was a coup. The government there was ousted by force.
Bernie, thanks for the call. So the United States has not only used but abused its leadership position around the world in the last 60 years or so, Bruce.
Yeah, there's no question that we have at times. I don't use the phrase moral high ground in the book. The case I make is that when you look at states' interests, and I think that it's very important to bring it down to interests, we simply see an underlying reality that the power we have is not checked by any of these other actors. And there's this very interesting phenomenon that for China, for India, for Brazil, less so for Russia, they look at American power, they see some of the constraints it imposes on them. They see some of the downsides. They see some of the times when we've used our power in aggressive ways. But they also see that if American power retreated from their region, they'd be faced with a vacuum and with conflict, and that there are a whole host of other things that the United States does. You know, it's the U.S. Navy that maintains the security of the flow of oil out of the Gulf, out of the Straits of Hormuz. Every major economy in the world is dependent on that, none more than China and India. So they're in a sort of funny position where, on the one hand, they're a little bit sympathetic to the last caller. They see some of the strains that come out when the United States uses its power in unilateral ways or uses its power aggressively. On the other hand, they recognize that there are whole critical functions of the global economy and stable flow of energy, stability in key regions that are really dependent on American power, and that it's in their interest that things continue that way, at least to some degree.
Thanks for the call, Bernie. Now we have Sundar on the line in Milwaukee. Sundar, hi.
Hello. How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I just wanted to make a comment. Having lived in India the first 20 years of my life and in the States the last 20 years, I think American leadership is still very, very important globally. I think we're just at a stage where we're trying to find a balance in that leadership, especially the post-George Bush era. And I think what Obama is trying to do is find a semblance of balance to basically address Asia, the Middle East, and Europe. And as time evolves, I think we will find the balance. I do remember my dad, who was pretty much a moderate. He was very thrilled when George Bush decided to, you know, to take on Al-Qaeda, basically, in Afghanistan.
Sundar, I want to jump in and give Bruce Jones a chance to respond. Are you optimistic, Bruce, that we're going to find the balance you've written about that Sundar was talking about?
I'm an inveterate optimist, so I tend to agree. Yeah, look, I do think that it's well put. This notion of balance, and it's of two types. I use the phrase in the book that the United States needs to lead, not dominate. There have been times when we've conflated the concept of leadership with the aggressive use of unilateral military power. There are going to be times and places where we have no choice but to pursue military action unilaterally, but it should be the last resort, and we should exhaust all of our other options before we do that, and that got out of balance. And so this notion of balance between coalition building on the one hand and military power on the other is very important, as is this notion of balance between the dynamics of rivalry and the restraint that's potentially there if we focus on it and build up our patterns of cooperation where we have shared interests.
We'll leave it there. Bruce, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Bruce Jones. He's Senior Fellow and Director of the International Order and Strategy Project at Brookings. His new book is Still Ours to Lead.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at what's going on in Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
First, we're zeroing in on a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Justices are debating whether or not for-profit businesses who object to contraception for religious reasons should have to cover it under the new health care law.
The case is centered in part around craft store Hobby Lobby, whose owners say they want to follow biblical principles while operating in a secular marketplace. Experts say the political implications of this ruling could be a big deal, especially important for President Obama's health care law.
Political scientist Kimmy King is with us to explain what's going on with the case so far. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good morning. Afternoon. Sorry, how are you? It's a long day.
One or the other, right? Well, let's start with the basics. Can you summarize the case for us? What's it about?
Yeah. Where this came from, as you know, the Supreme Court has previously ruled that Congress did have the authority to pass the Affordable Care Act. And that was already a contentious decision that had been 5-4 back in 2012. And that just simply examined whether or not Congress had the power to do this. And the court held there that, yes, in fact, they do. They left open the issue of how it is applied in a variety of different circumstances, and be ready because this is probably just going to be the first of many cases that tries to litigate over it. In essence, what has gone on is you have private companies, one Conestoga Wood, another AutoCam, which is an auto and medical manufacturer, and then Hobby Lobby, which is the one that everybody knows about, which have challenged the Affordable Care Act and the requirement that they as employers provide health care that includes birth control, which they consider to be abortion-related. And so they are challenging, in essence, claiming that their religious freedom is burdened because they do not want to be paying for health care insurance, which could, in essence, terminate life, like intrauterine devices. And so in the Third Circuit, Conestoga Wood, and in the Sixth Circuit, AutoCam, had been successful in saying, we're sorry, private companies, you may say it violates your religious freedom because you don't want to pay for this funding because you as the employer have religious beliefs that are pro-life. But in the Tenth Circuit, Hobby Lobby won, and the Tenth Circuit said that this did burden their religious beliefs and that government had not shown that it had a compelling government interest in requiring private employers pay for this kind of birth control. And that's why we're here.
And this has been, as you summarized, it's bounced around the circuit courts, and it seems to be right now dividing along partisan lines with Justice Anthony Kennedy probably looking to be the deciding vote. Can you sort of summarize the arguments that we've been hearing so far?
Sure. So, and Kennedy is the one that everybody's watching, and everyone is pinning on him. And I will remind everyone that when the Affordable Care Act was being challenged, everybody was looking at Kennedy as being the swing voter. And then as it turned out, it was Chief Justice John Roberts, which cast the deciding vote to uphold the affordable health care under the taxing and spending clause. So all the political pundits may have it wrong. But here's in essence what the case boils down to. The question is, how do the standards apply for religious freedom? And do private corporations, are they protected by the same freedom of religion principles that individuals are protected by? There have been a series of decisions going back in time where the court has looked at different things, not only just religious freedom, but how the states might limit religious freedom. Are corporations considered to be persons within the meaning of the Constitution? Can the federal government mandate certain kinds of programs that might not otherwise be acceptable by the general population? And so that's why this case is so interesting to so many people, because it pulls on a wide-ranging set of case law and different legal principles to look at whether or not corporations can have religious beliefs and can they avoid being subject to regulations because of those religious beliefs.
And some of the justices questioning the lawyers for the corporation saying, well, how does a corporation express religious belief? And, you know, there are echoes, as you said, of Citizens United going back to 2010, that controversial Supreme Court ruling that corporations can be, in effect, people. What's at stake here with the answer to these questions?
Yeah, so in the case of Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, there had been a long line of history that had said that corporations have speech. It's easier to make the argument that corporations have speech. It's not so easy to say, well, how do corporations, do they pray? Do they attend religious worship? Isn't something like religion inherently fundamental? And Citizens United may be distinguishing because it looks at that issue of participating in the political process. And so people are saying that Kennedy may draw a distinction there because, remember, he said corporations were individual, you know, had that ability to express themselves. But here's the difficult thing. Kennedy, going back in time, also signed, he was the author of a decision in City of Burney versus Flores. There, the Supreme Court slapped Congress back when Congress tried to pass the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to protect religious freedom. There, Kennedy said that the Supreme Court decides what the standards are, and that, here's the touchstone for your listeners, what the court is in essence looking at under religious freedom is whenever government looks to place a substantial burden on your religious freedom, it has to show a compelling government interest. So corporations have to show how they are substantially burdened in their religious freedom and how, even if that's the case, what is government's compelling interest? Because government can still burden you if they have a compelling interest. So is health care a compelling interest? Is it a burden on religious freedom? Those are the kinds of issues that the justices are going to be, you know, arguing about as they decide this case.
And something else that may come into play in this is how is that question dealt with in organizations like churches and religious nonprofit groups? How will that play in?
Well, certainly, I mean, so some, you know, pundits are saying that Kennedy's going to try to find a real narrow ruling, because if they rule in favor of the three private plaintiffs, of the private corporations, you open up a Pandora's box. I'm a Christian Scientist, and I don't want to pay for vaccines. I don't want to, you know, another one would say, I don't want to pay for Social Security because I think that that's a public handout. And the Bible says, you know, you can see the various kinds of claims that will and challenges that will be made against the Affordable Care Act and indeed other federal laws should they rule that way. At the same time, the Obama administration has allowed nonprofit groups and other churches and, you know, like Notre Dame University and Georgetown, they have been given exemptions under the Affordable Care Act, saying we don't want to provide this kind of contraception because it violates our religious beliefs. How can the Obama administration say it has a compelling government interest in providing health care and birth control and, you know, give exemptions to some religious organizations and not to private religious corporations? And so that's the struggle that we're facing.
Now, I read today that there have been protesters outside the Supreme Court doors. What kinds of pressures are both sides facing as this unfolds?
Well, it's funny. Sandra Day O'Connor had a very famous quote way back when, saying that, you know, it was in the middle of the whole pro-choice, pro-life struggle over the abortion controversies in the early 80s. And she said, it makes a difference when you have 100,000 people outside your door. But, you know, certainly this court has already experienced some of this political controversy. Chief Justice John Roberts, when he came down in favor in supporting the Affordable Care Act, when he voted to uphold it, he left the country and went on vacation for 2 weeks because he knew there was going to be a firestorm associated with that decision. So, you know, we debate a lot whether the court is subject to public opinion. I think the harder issue for this court is how they are going to resolve the different doctrines relating to freedom of speech or freedom of religion, what the right standards ought to be, whether private corporations can have religious freedom. And looking back at the cases, you know, the case law that they have, they're going to have a really hard time reconciling the precedent. So I don't think they're going to be as worried about public opinion as they are trying to craft a rule of law that won't continue to cause further controversy and bring a whole bunch more claims. Because, you know, the implications of this are huge, not just for religion. Think about this most recent Arizona law where they, you know, Governor Brewer wound up vetoing the legislation, but there were a number of religious businesses for religious reasons which didn't want to serve the GLBT community. You can see the whole range of different issues that could be opened up as a result of allowing corporations to, you know, lay a claim to religious freedom.
Kimmy, thank you so much for joining us and shedding some light on this.
All right. You take care and go Public Radio.
All right. Thanks a lot. That was Kimmy King, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas, with us to talk about the Supreme Court case on government-mandated contraception coverage.
It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
Yesterday, President Obama announced that he is seeking to end bulk phone data collection. But how will Congress follow up on that proposal?
The Senate is in the midst of approving aid for Ukraine and authorizing sanctions against Russia. The U.S. government is concerned that Russia might not stop at Crimea.
And the enrollment period for health insurance through the government exchanges ends on Monday. Both Republicans and Democrats are eager to use whatever happens to bolster their cases in fall midterm elections, elections that popular statistics expert Nate Silver predicted this week might end with a Republican Senate.
Paul Singer joins us every Wednesday at this time to help make sense of everything Congress. Good to have you back, Paul.
Thanks. Good to be back with you.
So the White House, President Obama yesterday made some big news announcing that he wants to bring an end to the NSA's bulk phone data collection. I know some in Congress are trying to do something along the same lines. Is Congress going to be on board with what the president wants?
Probably not. I mean, I think they are on board with the general idea here is to get the government out of the business of collecting and holding large quantities of data. The question is how you do it. There are a couple competing legislative proposals already kicking around on Capitol Hill. I think some of the issues will be like, you know, how much permission does a judge have to give before some of this data can be opened by the FBI or other law enforcement? I think the questions become technical rather than ideological, because I think everybody does want to end this bulk collection. Some of those technical problems can really trip up a bill.
Well, with a plan for the president, you mentioned two plans in Congress. It could be a bit of a muddle, I think is the technical term. Is anything going to come out the other side on this?
You know, I think it will. This is one of those topics where there is a great deal of public agreement that something should be done. There is a great deal of agreement in Congress and in the White House that the programs as currently constructed are a bad idea and wildly unpopular. I mean, I think this is something that everybody realizes their constituents hate, and so they're going to want to try and fix it somehow. And keep in mind, we might not actually end up seeing the details of it in public because some of this is intelligence gathering stuff that may be done privately. It may be a confidential bill. I don't know.
So we'll know that something maybe has been done. We may not know exactly what.
That would not surprise me if they figure out some way to pass a bill that blurs over some of the details.
Huh. Well, also in the news, of course, Russia, Ukraine, Crimea, and Congress is working on this, looking at options for the U.S. Aid to Ukraine was stalled for a while. Has that been resolved?
It looks like it's been resolved. They were stalled over an argument over a Democratic proposal to restructure the International Monetary Fund. This was attached to the Ukraine aid bill, and Republicans didn't want to get involved. It was going to probably be more money for the United States contributions to the IMF and less U.S. control, more control for other governments. The Republicans did not think this was a good idea and didn't think it was worth getting into it on the Ukraine bill. So they weren't going to allow the bill to move. And the Democrats finally conceded that, you know what, we're not going to hold up this bill any longer for this issue. So they dropped the issue. So now it's a clean you would call it, Ukraine aid bill.
So they didn't need this IMF restructure to do what they wanted to do for Ukraine?
No, no. What they want to do for Ukraine is $150 million in cash, $1 billion in loan guarantees, and authorization for the president to pursue sanctions against Russia. The IMF stuff was the caboose on the train, and they could do without it.
President Obama's already been announcing sanctions on Russia. What does he need or want from Congress, and what are they doing?
Well, you know, the thing with the sanctions on Russia that we've thus far imposed are pretty piddling. It's sanctions against a bunch of individuals and their assets. They've attempted to sanction a couple of banks. But what Obama is really looking for is, first, the authority to go after broad sections of the Russian economy, like the energy sector, for instance. And second, I think more important even, is international agreement to enforce sanctions broadly. Sanctions that are imposed just by the U.S. are not going to be particularly influential if the Europeans are not playing along as well. So that's part of his European trip this week, has been all about that.
Turning to health insurance now, the Affordable Care Act, less than a week till the deadline to apply to enroll for health insurance through government exchanges. That's coming up Monday, though, a little wiggle room given by President Obama if people get stuck along the way. What kind of discussion are we hearing from people in Congress about that?
Well, you know, it depends what party you're in, right? as usual, Democrats, well, let me just back up. Our analysis at this point suggests that the administration is going to get somewhere around the 6 million enrollments they wanted by the end of March. They may not get to the 7 million they had originally thought they needed, but I think they're going to cross the 6 million threshold, which they will declare a victory. They'll say, look, it's now the law. It's the law of the land. The American people are engaged and enrolled, and it's good. Republicans are saying, here is the administration again changing a deadline. As you suggested, they moved the sort of last-minute deadline for a couple of weeks for some people, probably a very small group. Republicans are saying they're moving the deadlines, they're changing the law unilaterally, it's still a bad idea, it's going to cost people a lot more money, and let us run the Congress and we'll fix it. It's going to be their campaign theme for the rest of the year.
And speaking of campaigns, Nate Silver, the pollster who got a lot of attention in the run-up to the presidential race, and he predicted it pretty solidly. He said in his latest snapshot, the Republicans have a pretty solid chance of taking the Senate seats that they need to take control of the Senate. Democrats, not happy about that. What's been the reaction?
I mean, this is the stuff that drives me nuts. I could have told you yesterday that the Republicans had a good chance to take the Senate. We've been reporting on this stuff all year long, and there's a bunch of Senate races where the Democrats look weak, et cetera, et cetera. What Nate Silver does is he runs a bunch of numbers through a model, and he comes up with a sort of percentage result based on what we know today. And so what we know today is, surprise, surprise, it looks like Republicans are in a good place to take back the Senate. Yippee. The Democrats went bananas because they think that Nate Silver said it must be true. I think that the Democrats are attacking Nate Silver as a way of frightening their base into giving more money. Nate Silver says we're going to lose. You better give us more money. But this is all nonsense. I mean, we're 6 months away from an election. Who knows what's going to happen between now and then? All Nate Silver is doing is taking current existing polls that tell you exactly what you think they'd say, that the Democrats are in trouble and the Republicans are on the advantage. Great. Thanks, Nate.
Well, speaking of polls, you at USA Today released a poll recently about Americans' satisfaction with congressional politics. What did we learn from that?
Poll.
That was a really good one, huh?
Yeah, that one I liked. And it's interesting. I mean, the thing that we found that's most interesting is that Americans are sort of increasingly happy with a dysfunctional, divided Congress. They are saying basically that having strong partisan differences, one, prevents Congress from getting stuff done, which is okay because it stops dumb ideas from becoming law, and two, gives the voting public a real distinct choice between the Democrats and Republicans, and they like that.
And that's interesting. Well, Paul, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. We'll talk to you in a week.
That was Paul Singer. He's Congress and Politics Editor at USA Today. He joins us each Wednesday at this time to talk about the latest in politics. You can share your thoughts with us. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.